Okay, so welcome to this special asset colloquium this evening, and also warm welcome to our very own Joe Philip Maynard. Many of you know him, he is our own graduate student, of course. So today we're going to talk about a very, very interesting topic, developing the next generation extreme precision radial velocity spectroscopy in the context of research for ECHO. Many of you will remember, not long ago, maybe 8 months back, he spoke particularly about the ground-based infrared activities and also the future prospects at GIFR, that was in July 2016. So, glad to again have him here, talking about the continuing work at his postdoc period. To go over briefly his CV, he of course, as I said, joined GIFR in 2010. Obtained his PhD and then worked at David Roja in 2016, and he worked basically on the near infrared instrumentation for developing a near infrared imager and spectrograph, which is called TILSPAC, for a 2-meter Himalayan Chandra telescope. And now he's a postdoctoral researcher at Penn State in US, where he is essentially continuing work on similar field, but specifically working on IR detector and instrument development for very high precision radial velocity measurements, particularly searching for exoplanets. And that is what the topic for today's colloquium. I think just since he gave the last research colloquium, he already won two very prestigious awards. One is Geeta Upgankar Award. As you know, it is given for the best thesis award in TIFR, and also followed by INSA and a medal for Young Scientist in 2017, both this year. So riding quite high on those. Let us now welcome Joe for his very exciting colloquium this evening.
Thank you, Dr. Satya, for the generous introduction. It's really a great pleasure and a great privilege to be back here at TIFR. I think it's been almost 1 year and a half, as Satya's mentioned, since I gave the previous asset colloquium. So I'm really excited to share with you the new work which I'm mostly doing there at Penn State with the HPF and the NUIT team. So Penn State is, by the way, Pennsylvania State University, probably your. All right, so I'll try to give this talk with a brief overview on how we are developing this next generation high velocity spectrograph. Mainly to find exo-Earths, which are exoplanets, which are like planets like Earth, but they are going around other stars in our sky. And this is something which has mesmerized humanity for a long time. Like the earliest record goes up to almost 300 BC, where people have been speculating that there could be many worlds like our own Earth with their own life forms and all the stuffs. And in fact, so you can see that, well, maybe not all the humanity, but at least some philosophers always speculated that there are worlds like our own Earth far out, which are just waiting to be discovered. In fact, Huygens even wrote a book in 1698 on these possibilities of exoplanets around the stars. So it's a really long history of almost more than 2 millennia. So I'll give this talk by giving a very brief introduction for non-astronomy background audience about what an exoplanet is and why we are looking for them around a certain kind of stars, which I will be talking about in a few minutes. And we'll quickly go into the main theme of the talk, which is how to build the next generation high precision spectrograph to detect these planets. And I'll also end my talk by giving some early results of our spectrographs. Okay, so as I mentioned, trying to discover the planets, people have been speculating these planets for almost 2 millennia, but only in the last 1 century people actually tried to claim that they have discovered planets. And sadly, for almost a century, starting from 1900s, all of them turned out to be spurious detections, like none of them were real planets. So only in like 1980s, towards the end of 1980s, we actually started having real solid discoveries. But once we started discovering, thanks to the technological development, it has been an exponential increase in the number of planets and which we have been discovering. So this plot here shows the years, starting around, you can see around 1989, and what is shown on y-axis is the cumulative number of exoplanet detections. These red color, these colors in this bar shows the ways we are detecting these planets, which I will be talking about in the next slide. But the main theme of this graph is that you can see that there is no stopping in the number of exoplanets we have been discovering. So it's been kind of continuously increasing. And this is actually a screenshot from exoplanets.org, who keeps on updating their database each time a new planet is discovered. This is just screenshot from like 2-3 days ago. Alright, so what are the methods of detection? So how do we detect these planets which are going around different faraway stars? There are many ways of detecting it, but most of the stars are discovered by 4 different methods. The first one is the most simplest, which is the transit method. So what happens is, when a planet moves in front of a star, you kind of block that much of the light from the star. So you have to just keep measuring the total brightness of the star, and you will see a dip in it. And as soon as the planet leaves the face of the star, it will come back to the same point. So this looks like a fairly simple thing, but it just took us technology which we developed over the last 20-30 years to actually detect this small minute variation of 0.00001 fraction of light change. So this is the most common method, and which is probably the most popular because of the recent explosion of exoplanets discovered by Kepler. Now the next method which I will be talking about is the radial velocity method, which is what I will be talking about most of in the talk. So this is kind of an indirect method again. You have the star going, planet going around a star, and we know that when two bodies orbit around each other, they go around the common center of mass, which means the star also goes around in a small circle. Of course, this is highly exaggerated. In case of real stars, typically this is still within, this orbit is still inside the star. But what you'll notice is that as the star oscillates, as it moves towards you and away from you, you will get the Doppler shift in its spectrum, which is what is shown here. You can see that the spectrum is slowly moving forward and backward. As the star comes towards you, it will get blue shifted. As it moves away from you, it gets red shifted. Now this is what we will be trying to detect whenever I say radial velocity detection. So this velocity is because we are only measuring the velocity in the radial direction to us. Now these two methods are sort of complementary, because transit method will always tell you the size of the planets. There is really no direct, well, I mean, there is an indirect way of knowing the mass of the planet if there are multiple planets, and then you look for the interaction between the planets, is something called transit time variation. But otherwise, transit method, if it is, especially if there's only one planet, you'd really have no clue on the mass of the planet, because all you get is the size of the planet. Radial velocity method, on the other hand, gives you the mass of the planet, well, the minimum mass of the planet, because you still don't know the inclination angle, but that's usually not a big problem. You get the mass of the planet there. So once you have the mass and the radius, then only you can talk about the density. And why density is important? Because that's how we differentiate whether the planet is a gas giant or a rocky planet like our Earth. Radial velocity. So you measure the redshift. So you measure the Doppler shift and then just multiply it by the velocity of light, you get the velocity of the object.
And these planets are in our spiral galaxy.
These are all the detections.
Milky Way, same galaxy.
Yes. Yeah. They are, in fact, what I'll be talking about are all within a few parsecs, like maybe 50 parsec, 100 parsec, not more than that. These are all nearby. So the other method is this gravitational lensing method. Unfortunately, I don't have a video for it, but the concept is fairly simple. You have your main host star, which kind of acts like a lens, and if there is a background star moving with respect to this, if there were no planets, as the star moves behind this star, you will get a gravitational lensing effect, which will kind of increase the brightness of this background star like a curve which goes up and down as it passes by. But if there is a planet, then that planet will have its own tiny effect on the lens. You will essentially get a spikes here. So this is again another way of people have discovered exoplanets. And then probably the most straightforward method, but probably also the most useless method in some sense, is the direct imaging, where the nearest stars, you can actually have a coronagraph which masks out the bright light from the star so that you can see these faint planets going around it. Right. Now, all these methods are complementary, as this plot will show you, which shows the orbit of the planet versus the mass of the planet. So, as you would have guessed, these direct imaging methods, if you have to block the light from the star and still see the planets, they are really far away from the planet star. So, all these direct imaging method planets you can see are like very farther away, outer orbit, like kind of a Jupiter, farther away sort of planets. And all the transits, the probability of you a planet coming between you and the star is much, much higher if the planet is very close to a star because of that angle probability. So, most of the transits that you detect are all in this tiny short orbit periods. So, the red dots here are the transit method detected planets. The blue are the direct imaging. And this line over here is called the snow line. It is the name for the radius at which the water becomes ice. So, this is the water snow line. And near this place is where the water can exist in liquid form, which is exciting for us because that is where we expect the habitable planets to be formed, because at least all the life forms that we know uses water in some liquid form in one way or other. And radial velocities, kind of the detections by the radial velocities are usually kind of clustered around this, which is kind of pretty nice. And
So
you can see that there is an estimate for these masses so that I can make these plots, but these are actually highly model dependent. Based on the radius, you assume a certain kind of material.
So these are basically your hot Jupiters and all. So
hot Jupiters will be in the high mass.
Yeah. So you said that they are, so basically they are much away from the snow line as well, right?
They are much inside.
Yeah.
Yeah. They are like hot Jupiters.
This snow line corresponds to one solar star or depends on the host star?
Yeah.
Yeah, this depends on the host star. So, this is semi-major axis divided by snow line. So, it's kind of normalized with respect to the snow line. So, you can see that the snow line is actually at one. So, this axis is normalized to snow line. That's why it looks like a vertical line instead of going this way. Oh, sorry. All right. So, now as we're talking about, all exoplanets are interesting, even hot Jupiters are interesting, even tiny exoplanets are interesting for many reasons. But habitable zone is kind of specially interesting because we are more interested in finding planets which could potentially harbor life. Because we know only one, which is Earth, and it would be nice to have companions. So exo-Earth is a term which is commonly used these days to talk about exoplanets which are rocky planets like our Earth. And they should always have the same size of Earth, and it should be going around sun-like stars. And they should be inside the habitable zone. So, habitable zone is, as I said, is defined to be, I mean, there are some debates on what exactly is the upper limit and lower limit of the habitable zone, but generally it is where you can have liquid water. And these lines, so this plot here shows the distance, again the orbital distance from the star, and this is the mass of the star which it is going around. So, this is one solar mass, you can see the sun. By the way, these colors are the actual colors of the stars. For non-astronomy audience, this is how astronomers classify the stars based on the temperature. You can have really hot blue stars, you can have like really cool red stars, which are what we'll be calling M dwarfs. And the sun is somewhere over here, it's like yellowish green guy over here. Alright, now our little Earth is here, and what you see are these some exoplanets which are we're known to fall in the habitable zone places, and these are of course the our own planets which are far away. What I would like to point out here is this nice feature, like this axis is first of all in the logarithmic scale. As you go to a smaller and smaller stellar mass, you will see that the habitable zone comes really close to the star, which is really nice. From many perspectives, these smaller and smaller stars which I was talking about, M dwarfs, are actually the silent majority of our galaxy. If you look out on a clean, perfectly clear sky, perfectly clear dark night sky, not a single one of the star that you see is an M dwarf. You will not see any M dwarfs. But still, if you actually use much more longer wavelength telescopes and you look at, you will find that we are actually surrounded by M dwarfs all around. So this video actually shows, as you move away from the sun, as you go out, once you escape the Oort cloud, just keep the, these are closest neighbor Alpha Centauri, just look at how many red stars appear in the neighborhood. None of these stars are visible by our naked eye, but we are pretty much surrounded by these M dwarfs. Like 70% of the stars are M dwarfs, and they are our closest neighbors. So which is why we are more interested in them, because if there is life, it would be really nice to have them near to us for studying them much more clearly. And now, what are these M dwarf stars? How are they classified? So it's traditionally astronomers used to classify M dwarfs based on detection of TIO band absorptions in blue-green range. Later people realized that some other things can also happen at near infrared wavelengths, but that's a historical accident. Basically, these M dwarf stars actually span a pretty big mass range, from 0.5 solar mass to almost 0.08 solar mass. And the coolest thing about this is that these stars have an age of trillions of years compared to the giga years that our sun have, which makes it really cool, because so far no M dwarf has finished its main sequence life since the beginning of our universe, because the universe is much younger than this. And this large period, like the trillions of years, makes it also statistically the most likely place for complex life forms to evolve. Like, you have plenty of time. Then, like a cherry on cream, there are more things nice about this. For example, the recent studies of Kepler have shown that you have almost 3.5 times more chance of having rocky planets around these kind of stars than the more bigger F, G or K type stars. And they also have almost 2 times less chance to have big hot Jupiters like Neptunes or higher size giants near the inner orbit, which will destroy any tiny planets around them.
So these last 2 points are what, empirical statements?
These are empirical observational statements. We are still understanding why that is so. So these are just observational evidences. Sure.
The sizes that are shown in this band, they are the sizes of these objects in the band.
Oh, in the band? Okay.
These are planets.
Yeah.
What is the size represent? Is it scaled up on Earth? It's the real size of the planet?
So this, you can see the Earth is here. So these sizes are scaled with respect to the Earth over here.
So they are larger entities.
Yeah.
Down to.
That's true. No, you have smaller entities as well. Usually it's easier to detect larger planets. It's more like, it's pretty much all the initial planets we are discovering were all large, because the transit, the dip in the light is much higher if the planet is larger.
So it is not a statement that this is what they are, but
no, right, no. Yeah. So even these statistics which I mentioned, 3.5 times, this is after correcting these observational biases. So these numbers are estimated. So you look at, like, what's the probability of detecting, what's the completeness criteria, and then you calculate these ratios. So there's quite a lot of statistics behind the scenes in getting these numbers, which I just kind of skipped through. Alright, so M dwarfs are interesting, and they're like something which is, this image always amuses me, like, because this is the one of the famous TRAPPIST-1 system, which made a lot of news, I think around 6 or 7 months ago, where they discovered 7 planetary system. And you could see that the entire size of this planetary system fits inside our solar system. So this is a Mercury orbit, our innermost planet, and the entire planetary system fits inside. It's almost comparable to our Jupiter and the moon. So it's really tiny, which makes them so easy to detect and really cool to have life form if there is, like, you can actually jump over these planets. So these factors all make them really nice things to detect. For instance, like, the if there is a planet in the habitable zone in an M dwarf kind of stars, you have almost 2% chance of detecting it. Yeah.
So
planets, but M dwarfs are interesting because, like, even a small planet could perturb its spectra, right? That's why M dwarfs are interesting.
Right. That's true.
It's not only that they are abundant, but for the same mass of planets, it can actually do a lot of relative changes in their doctorship.
Absolutely right. So that's what this bullet I was going to say. So on top of the fact that they are so abundant, like they are near to us, there are plenty of them near to us, and there are plenty of them than any other kind of stars. They are easy to detect by almost all both these mothers. Like the probability of transiting if there is a planet in the habitable zone is almost 2%, while in comparison to a sun-like star, it's only 0.47%. Assuming isotropic universe that all planets can be of any orientation. Even the amplitude, because the star itself is small compared to the planet, the amplitude of the dip in that transit detection is almost typically around 1.3 millimag, while in case of sun it would be around 0.084 millimag. So you can see that they are much easier to detect, and as he correctly pointed out, the radial velocity amplitude, because the ratio of the masses between this planet and this low mass star is much smaller, you will have much higher radial velocity. So you typically have almost 2.5 times more radial velocity amplitude in the Doppler shift than if that planet was going around the sun. So this is just a scaling formula for this. So it's all nice, it's like perfect, so we should be going after this. However, nature always likes to be not so easy with us. They have their own challenges. For example, the first one is that these M dwarfs pretty much have really big convective zones, and they are highly active. They have strong magnetic fields, and they always give flares, which makes it really difficult to get a millimagnitude level photometry precision. You can have these sunspots which will screw up your radial velocity measurements. I will be talking about that later in this talk. And very sadly, the orbital period of planets in the habitable zone in some of these M dwarfs almost matches the rotational velocity of the star. So it will be almost, it will be very tricky. I mean, you can do it, it will be going to be very tricky to disentangle a signal that you detect, to disentangle it from any activity on the stellar surface itself. And they are too faint in optical. The very sad reason, in spite of them being there in so abundance, we can't see them, means that you can't detect them in most of the optical high resolution spectrographs people have developed. You need to build near infrared spectrographs for this. But these stars have like temperatures of around 2500 Kelvin or so. So that's the reason why you have to, they peak in near infrared. Ring planets?
Ring planets like Saturn.
Oh yeah, so there has been some exoplanets which, so essentially when you look at the transit, you look at how the way they fall in that dip. So people, so you sometimes in couple of exoplanets, they didn't really follow a spherical object. So people have been trying to model it with rings and as well as cometary tails. So yes, we have detected weird exotic exoplanets as well. Yes, that's true. Alright, so that is where our two spectrographs we are developing at Penn State comes in. So the first one is the habitable zone planet finder. This is tailor made for detecting habitable zone planets around M dwarf stars. So this is an artist's impression of an M dwarf star and a planet. So initially, the developing an ultra-stable spectrograph in near-infrared has always been a challenge. So previously, before we started HP, of the literature studied well-known F ranges people have achieved were somewhere around like 10 meter per second, 15 meter per second and so on. So when the Penn State team proposed HPF, we proposed for 5 meter per second. But as we developed, the technology developed, and then there were other instruments also being developed, we realized that we can do much better than that. So now we are almost certain that we will be reaching 1 meter per second. And I will be showing you some slides of what we actually saw in our lab and things like that. So this spectrograph is a near infrared spectrograph, and we have, so once we are developing this, then NASA every decade puts out, forms a consortium and figures out what is that they should concentrate in the next 10 years or so. So as part of the decadal survey, they said they started a program called NN Explore. So essentially the idea is that they want to push for developing ultra stable spectrographs which can detect earth like planets around sun like stars. So before then, the gold standard now was HARPS spectrum. I know how many of you might have heard of it. So HARPS was the first revolutionary spectrograph in this way, radial velocity field, where they showed that they can go up to 1 meter per second in optical. So NASA called for a proposal for centimeter per second level in development of instrumentation, and various teams competed, and the Penn State team won the competition for developing this instrument called NOID, which has a long name called NN Explore Exoplanet Investigation with Doppler Spectroscopy. But actually the NOID, we prefer to say it's not an acronym, it's actually means to see in the native language of Tohono. I don't know whether I pronounce that right. So this is a Native American tribe where the observatory is located. So we are using their land for our telescope as well as a site. So as a tribute to them, we are using this name for our instrument. Now we propose that we will be able to reach 29 centimeter per second for this spectrograph. And this is going to be in optical. So we have much more better technology in that way. So this is how we ended up building two spectrographs instead of one. All right, now when I said 29 centimeter per second, it's actually really crazy than it sounds, because what actually does it mean to detect some radial velocity shift of 29 centimeter per second? On a normal spectrograph CCD like what we are building, the typical pixel size will be of 10 micron pixel. And the shift that you have to detect, that shift in the spectrum that you have to detect, just correspond to 5 atoms inside that silicon CCD. So what is shown here, these are the atoms inside the silicon atoms, and the 10 centimeter per second, which is by the way the velocity of the sun because of the earth, the pull of the earth on our sun, is just 10 centimeters. So essentially we have to detect a shift in spectrum at this sub or few atom level size based on the spectrum of the star, which is really cool. It's kind of like, I mean, it's not as cool as LIGO where they detect shifts in like Fermi level, but considering the fact that we don't have a huge laser and we are just doing it with stellar light, it is actually super cool. All right, so now I'll go to the main part, like how do we actually make this highly ultra stable spectrograph, and that too twice. So this is the explored view of habitable zone planet finder, which is the near infrared spectrograph, and this is the optical counterpart of that. And it's not an accident that they look very similar, but they're not quite same. But the basic optical design of these spectrographs over the last few decades have pretty much converged onto this white standard white people design. It's conceptually very simple. You have your light entering your spectrograph through here. You collimate it onto your S-shell grating for really high dispersion, and then you recollimate that back onto the pupil of your cross disperser, which is why it has a white pupil name called white pupil design. And the cross disperser can be a prism, or in case of HPFV, something called VPH. I'll mention it towards when we talk more in detail about cross dispersers. And once you cross disperse the S-shell spectrograph, you just, this is just an ordinary camera which images that spectrum onto a detector over here. All right, so how do we build it? The first thing you have to do to make a spectrograph stable is to keep it on a stable location. If you know how all azimuth telescopes works, the telescope has a focal plane here and the telescope moves around looking wherever it is looking. And your focal plane essentially shifts along with telescope. So there is no way you can attach your spectrograph onto the focal plane of the telescope, because as it moves around, your spectrum goes upside down. So you have to essentially take the light from the focal plane of the telescope to some stable place where you can keep your spectrograph stable. So people figured this out long back. In fact, Larry Ramsey, who is our oldest member in our team, was one of the pioneers in using optical fibers for the spectrographs once it started becoming available in 1980s. And the idea is very simple. you take the light from your star in the optical fiber. This is, by the way, one of the images of one of our optical fibers. And you take it to your spectrograph, put a slit at the end of the spectrograph, and you get light into your spectrograph. Now, that's easily said than done, because optical fibers introduce way more, lot more other complications than if you didn't have anything at all. The first thing is to realize that optical fibers, the right way to think about optical fibers is not as photons totally internally reflecting through it. They are essentially waveguides, and like any other light waveguides, you have many modes of propagation in an optical fibers. And all this finite number of modes, if you have a coherent laser light passing through, will destructively and constructively interfere, giving you a speckled pattern at the output of the fiber. So this is the output of our fiber. We have put a slit, that's why this is in rectangular shape, and you end up getting the speckled pattern. Now this is really dangerous for radial velocity studies, because what will be the spectrograph is actually doing is re-imaging this for this wavelength onto the detector. Now if you have these speckled patterns, when you actually calculate the centroid, which is what the line position is, this will be very sensitive to this pattern you see, and if you breathe onto the fiber, this pattern will change completely. So this is super sensitive because these are just light interferences. So what we found was that the best way to solve this is to just make it worse, which means like you, if you keep moving your fiber, like if a grad student just keeps moving the fiber up and down, these pattern changes randomly very fast, and over your short exposure time, they essentially average out. So a lot of research and development on replicating a grad student moving the hand went on to development of this simple device. So this is the fiber which before entering the spectrograph, we have it pass through what we call mechanical SAM, which keeps oscillating the fibers, which means that it will essentially average out all the model noise coming through the fiber. And that will give you a really smooth averaged out plane of this. So that is one problem. So you solve that problem by that. The next problem is that this is actually true even if you are not using an optical fiber. If the star is not at the slit has finite width. So if your star is not at the center of the slit, and if it slightly moves this way or that way because of the telescopes moving around, you will end up having different illumination on the other side. Like your entire spectrum will also get shifted this way and that way, which will be a huge radial velocity shift. So which will completely blow away your error budget. So this is what happens, the simulation shows. If you have a star entering the optical fiber input at different positions, this is the output of that optical fiber. And this is completely unacceptable to get a uniform illumination. So a lot of R&D was done on how to scramble this input so that you get a stable output illumination irrespective of how the light enters the optical fiber. So people have shown that if you use a polygonal shaped optical fiber instead of circular, your scrambling is usually better. And a lot of experiments finally converged to a system of development of something called ball line scrambler. So this was again developed at Penn State. The idea is to use a simple ball lens of refractive index 2, which is kind of nice because then the focal length of that sphere, irrespective of the radius, will always be on the back surface of that ball lens. Which means that if you connect an optical fiber coming from here, the near field of the far field of this fiber gets converted into near field at the entrance of this fiber. So you're actually transforming. So at the near field is, you can think of near field as the flux illumination at the exit of the fiber, far field as the angle at which the light is coming out of the fiber. So you essentially convert them, invert them, like near field becomes far field becomes near field, and then you reinsert that into this fiber. And this fiber is then spliced onto a circular fiber which goes onto a slit. So this combination was found by various trial and error methods empirically, and this is the final result that you see. Sorry. You can see as you move this, the star light from one position of the fiber to the other side of the fiber, you hardly see any variation at all in the output of the fiber. So now that we have figured out how to give a stable illumination onto the spectrograph, the next thing is to make the spectrograph itself stable. On an average day, your temperature here changes, the pressure changes typically like 3 torr, which itself will correspond to change in the refractive index of the medium inside the spectrograph by almost 300 meter per second, which will again completely blow away your centimeter per second accuracy you are looking for. So the natural thing to do is put your entire optical bench inside a big chamber, pump it to vacuum. By the time you reach almost around 10 power minus 3 torr, you have solved this problem. You won't have much significant contribution in the refractive index changes because of the pressure changes. However, so earlier I talked about HARPS, the current gold standard. So that's where they stopped. But we want to make something way more stable, and we want the entire instrument to be thermally stable as well. So if you actually stop at 10 power minus 3, your optical bench is still thermally connected to the outside chamber by the molecular convections. To reduce that thermal coupling and just make it purely radiative coupling between the optical bench and the outside chamber, you have to go down to almost 10 to the power minus 7 tau. So this is where we had to use activated charcoal getters, and since the chamber we made was made out of steel, we had some hydrogen degassing issues. So we added a next door hydrogen getter as well, which enabled us to go down in pressure all the way up to 10 power minus 8 actually 3 days ago when I just looked up the plot. So we are doing pretty good on the vacuum, which makes it really stable to avoid any other artifacts. So now that we have a good vacuum, so this by the way is the plot which shows the temperature stability versus pressure, and you can see HARPS was right here, the current gold standard. We reduce the pressure all the way down to here. Now we can actually attain temperature stability to that millikelvin because optical bench is now only radiatively coupled with the outside thing. Now how do we make a big piece of aluminium chunk sub millikelvin stable was the next biggest challenge. That is probably where a lot more of our research and development went into. So finally we had a system, for example case of HPF. You have the liquid nitrogen tank here, which is connected, thermally connected by copper straps all around the optical, the system. And if you just leave it there passively, that will bring down the temperature to almost 160 to 170 Kelvin. And now you want to actively control the temperature. So you have a lot of heating pads all around the instrument, which you heat, and you you have like pretty lot of thermal sensors, and you actively monitor the temperature, and you kind of, so you have essentially a control loop system, like you measure the temperature, you give the correction, and you keep it actively stable.
So what's the operating temperature then?
180 Kelvin. So for HPF, since it goes only up to 1.2 micron, you don't really, and since we used a custom detector, which I'll talk about, which has a cutoff at 1.7 micron, we don't really have much instrument contribution in terms of thermal radiation if you are at 180 Kelvin. We don't really have to go to 77 Kelvin like if you are using a 2.5 micron cutoff detector.
What's the allowed, allowed range for operation temperature?
So we would like to keep it somewhere around 180 plus or minus 8 Kelvin. So the way we chose is 180, it's actually not exactly 180, it's 181.74. It's based on the temperature at which we optimize the focus of the instrument. So we kind of get a slight focus control by changing the temperature. So basic idea is always same for the NUID on the other hand. So the, for any thermal control system, you need a heat sink and a heating source. And the heat sink has to be at lower temperature. For HPF, our liquid nitrogen tank was a heat sink. For NUID, we use the ambient room temperature itself as our heat sink. So we had to essentially heat the entire instrument up to 300 Kelvin as its operating temperature instead of the room temperature. All right. So this was the first time. So people have always thought that it's this. I am not, as far as I know, this is probably the biggest chunk of aluminium humans have ever kept stable at millikelvin level. So this is our first demonstration with the HPF chamber. We demonstrated that you can get up to 0.63 millikelvin temperature stability over a 15 day period and 0.14 millikelvin over a 1 day period. Now this was HPF. Now that we are developing with NUID, we added in more heaters, more control loops, more measurements. And we are now attaining over 30 day period something like 0.19 millikelvin, as well, or 10 day RMS is something like around 0.1 millikelvin. The entire weight I think is somewhere around 3 ton. That's the entire spectrograph, that includes a steel chamber. So the aluminum inner optical bench is smaller than that. I think it's somewhere around 900 pounds. Shubham, do you remember what is that? Yeah, it is somewhere around 900 pounds, which will be around 300-500 kg. Yeah.
So I
want
to challenge your statement.
But okay.
You kept things similarly.
Oh, this big?
Oh,
okay. Is it also this big?
It's much larger.
Okay.
It's in the underground lab in Gauribund.
Okay. Yeah, there'll be. So we put in lot of R&D in making this thing work. Pretty much, I would say a lot of effort in even like measuring sensing at this sub millikelvin level was challenging for us. But it'll be interesting to see how it was done here. All right. So once you attain this, so far no other spectrographs have ever attained cross the millikelvin barrier. So we are really happy to have reached sub millikelvin, and there are a lot of tiny issues here. For example, the liquid nitrogen fill, it has a liquid nitrogen tank, and you need to fill liquid nitrogen regularly to keep it filled. Now the question is, the liquid nitrogen temperature itself varies with the pressure. So you solve that problem by putting a back pressure regulator in the liquid nitrogen tank so that the pressure inside the liquid nitrogen tank remains constant. But when you fill the liquid nitrogen tank, you have to break that pressure. And plus about the temperature of the liquid nitrogen coming into the instrument from the outside, D-bar is at a different temperature because it's at a different pressure. So the way we kind of balance it is by you, before we fill, we release the back pressure, so which will essentially cool the instrument down just enough so that when we fill it with new warm liquid nitrogen, it exactly cancels out. So this involved a lot of tuning in the frequency at which we fill, automation and things like that. And there are also things like, as I was saying, a 5-atom shift in the detector will limit our detection, I mean prevent us from going to centimeter per second level. So even when you read out a detector, you are essentially passing current through it, which will heat it up, which can result it in wrapping like a potato chip. So you essentially read out the detector in a steady mode so that all those things are stable and all those things. And we also put the entire instrument inside a meat locker. We call it a meat locker because it is actually a meat locker, which is kind of a passive wall. And it pretty much filters out all the high frequency ventilation changes, etc., in your basement of the spectrograph. Yeah. And we have also publicly released all of our works, all of our modeling, all of the thermal modeling and etc., so that future instruments can build on top of our results. And the core of the spectrograph is of course the grating. So the grating is made of Cerador material. It is really small thermal expansion coefficient, something like 0.2 parts per million per Kelvin. So this is this material. So there's only one company which makes this kind of grating, which is the Newport Richardson Grating Labs. So this R4 is because we have a blaze angle of almost 75 degrees. It's a really high order S-shell spectrograph. And this is us inspecting the grating which arrived in our lab. The Cerador is really cool because of its stability, but it has one problem over time, which people discovered when they measured it in Harps. It kind of changes its phase. It slowly crystallizes, which means that over many years it keeps on shrinking. But luckily it's a very smooth curve, so you can essentially calibrate it and model it out. The next thing once you disperse it in the S-shell is to do the cross dispersion, which will split all the orders of the output spectrum. So in case of HPF, we use something called volume phase holographic grating, which is, so usually in a grating, you essentially want to make those phase differences so that they'll interfere consecutively and destructively to get the spectrum. So in VPH, you don't really rule anything. You change the refractive index of the material periodically so that it creates a phase difference as it comes out. So which is what was used in HPF. In case of NUAID, we could, since it's an optical thing, and we could go for a more standard prism. Even though I say standard prism, it is one of the biggest piece of glass block of this material people have made. So this is made by an O'Hara Corporation, but they couldn't of course make it to a prism, which is done by a company called Saigo, which many of you might have heard earlier. They are the same people who made the mirrors for the LIGO gravitational wave paper. And the way they make this is actually pretty cool. When you have such a big chunk of glass, you can't really have a uniform refractive index throughout. So even if you make both of your surfaces of the prism perfectly parallel, you will still have a wavefront error as the wave comes out. So the way Saigo people do is that they actually measure the wavefront error comes out and they actually polish it on the other side so that it compensates out the internal defects of the prism. And the final component is the camera. The camera, this is a really elegant design for NUIT. It looks pretty simple, but actually it's pretty cool, which Chris Schwab designed, who is part of our team. You can see that if you look at the typical wide pupil designs, yeah. Yes, because we are keeping that, that's why we had to keep the millikelvin level stability, so all those things will remain same. And there are some complications in it, like which polarization to correct, etc., which maybe after the talk I can talk more about, but otherwise that's fine. Alright, so the camera is actually, so if you look at these kind of systems, typically what there will be a kind of a cylindrical curvature in the focal plane because of this wide pupil design. Typically it is solved by putting a cylindrical lens very close to the CCD, which usually creates in effects like ghost, etc., because it's very close to CCD and perpendicular to CCD. So the way he solved this problem is really cool. Like, he essentially used a normal lens but slightly off-centered and tilted the CCD so that you essentially have the gap between them and you don't get any gaps. And maybe I'll just skip through it. So the spots, the way he constrained the spots is also really cool. The fact that you don't want any centroid shift to happen if the angle at which the light coming out of the fiber changes. So which means that your spot size has to be really tight, because the abrasion that comes out in your spot of an optical system is kind of the function of the angle at which comes, because that determines which path the light took. And so you need to have really constrained tiniest spot possible to get this level of meter per second, centimeter per second accuracy. And okay, the last component is the detector. So in HPFV, we use, since a near infrared detector, we use a standard Teledyne H2RG detector. Not really standard, it's a one with 1.7 micron cutoff. That's why we could use 180 Kelvin temperature. So the NUIT, we use more standard CCDs, like E2V CCDs, much bigger, 9K by 9K in size. And as I said earlier, the precision we need means that these CCD pixels are not really perfect grids, because they are made by masking and by light masking technique. So there are these pixel stitching errors at periodic boundaries. So we essentially have to calibrate all that out using laser combs in the actual data. Alright, so my favorite part of HPF was its detector, because I don't know, for some reason I am always, this detector always fascinates me because it's pretty weird in many ways. For those who are familiar with H2RGs, almost all the modern devices read out H2RG in something called up the ramp readout, where you read out non-destructively, like you are measuring the flux as the exposure is going on, you don't destroy the measurement, and you get all these weird kind of things like reset anomalies, where the first readout would be weird and then go back. And you get these cosmic ray hits, where when a cosmic ray hit comes, there's a sudden jump in the value of the pixel readout. And of course, there are these weird pixels which can do weird things. So many of this work was done to detect these kinds of artifacts, which is actually built based on the work done here at TIFR for the TIRSPEC instrument. Then once you remove that, the biggest non-Gaussian error in these detectors. So these detectors for HPF has to be calibrated at an unprecedented level. Like, no other instruments really requires you to do these kinds of precise calibrations. But for HPF to attain this, even a small flux change can artificially introduce wrong RVs in your spectrum. So all of this has to be very well calibrated. The thing is, the next thing is the bias fluctuation. So for a zeroth order, as you're reading out, your bias values in the detector will keep changing. To zeroth order, you can just remove it by using the reference pixels along the sides. But however, that will not remove any of the short time variations of the bias. So we developed a method which looks at the correlation in the readout values as we are reading out to remove, model the bias out and remove it. The non-linearity again is something people typically just use a polynomial and fix it, but for HPF you can't do that because you need to be much more accurate. So we developed various different models to see which one represents the non-linearity curve the best. One of my favorite was PADE model. These names are just because I use a PADE approximation somewhere in the thing, so it doesn't really mean that PADE discovered that model. So the different models we developed and we converged onto something which is much better than what is conventionally available in the literature for doing the non-linear correction. Then reciprocity failure is something old astronomers would remember who would have used emulsion plates. The thing is that the plates are used to be less sensitive to faint stars and more sensitive to bright stars, which is kind of like a nightmare scenario. Luckily for young astronomers, CCDs never had this problem, so we are all very happy. But then once H2RG came, this problem came back again. So H2RG detectors were found to have exactly the same problem. These people realized when they found that supernovas were faint supernovas were more fainter than they expected it to be, and bright supernovas were more brighter than they expected it to be, and they tracked down the problem to this reciprocity failure in these detectors. So the thing is that the faint stars, as you can, it actually changes from detector to detector. So for each detector, you have to calibrate it and find out how bad it is for your particular detector. The faint ones will be less sensitive and the bright ones will be more sensitive. So we developed a setup to essentially measure this reciprocity failure for our detectors and calibrate that out from our data. So persistence is again something which is ongoing. Usually whenever people get these, all these detectors are high persistence. Like if you shine them with the bright light, then you end up having that faint signal for a long period. So for most of the instruments, people will just wait for enough time so that it goes away. But for HPF, we can't do that because most of our stars are very bright. We are on a 10 meter telescope. And even if a faint little residue of the previous star is there on your new stars, you will get completely garbage radial velocities and you will end up with absolutely useless data. So we had to remove this persistence problem. So this is sort of work in progress. Like I was looking around and I found that the theory of fluorescence decay sort of matches mathematically very well with the persistence that we are detecting, because basically this also comes from the charge traps. So it seems to be working, but it's something I would say is work in progress to remove. Alright, so this is kind of the overview of the various error budgets. When we proposed that we can make 29 centimeter per second instrument, we showed them quantitatively what are the small steps in every single step, that what are the errors that we might get and how well we can constrain in a conservative level. So this 27 was actually a conservative estimate, and you can see that we have all these different large number of lists which I didn't really talk about in this talk, but if somebody is interested, we can always go through it. One thing I'd like to bring attention to is this thing, software algorithms, which itself is 10 centimeter per second. So even if we make huge progress in the hardware, the software algorithms that we are using are defective at that level. Alright, so what are the main issues in using algorithms? Pretty much anything you can think of affects us. For example, all HL spectrographs have this curvature. The question is, how will you convert this into a straight line spectrum? The dissector persistence I already mentioned, non-linearity bias. Okay, so this is something very specific to HPF because it's a fixed altitude telescope, which means that it tracks object by moving the focal plane to the secondary. So the total aperture of the telescope changes depending on where you're looking. So during an exposure, your telescope's aperture is changing, which makes it really weird effects on the final output spectrum. And even the things like barycentric correction has to be done at a much very careful level. If, for example, if you have a half an hour exposure, what is the epoch at which you are going to correct the barycentric velocity? And the answer is not the middle value or the average value. If you just use a constant flux model for the total half an hour exposure, you can have just error from the barycentric correction. By the way, barycentric correction is the correction for the Earth's velocity up of order of 30 centimeter per second. So you need to essentially weight your exposure, the flux in which is falling on your detector, as a function of your exposure time and calculate the barycentric velocity for that. various things. So I'll just quickly mention. Telluric. So yeah, so this is again one of the main reason why near infrared radio velocity is difficult. It is just the absorption because of the Earth's atmosphere. So that will not have any radial velocity signal. So your every stellar spectrum is imprinted by this telluric signatures on it. So you have to essentially remove these telluric features to get the star spectrum before you can start looking at what is the radial velocity shift. The telluric lines don't shift, they are on the, they are created by the Earth's atmosphere. Alright, so the first thing I'll just quickly mention over is this rectification problem which I talked about. So typically what people do is that you have to kind of map that two-dimensional curved thing into a straight single one-dimensional thing, and the standard practice is to just do an interpolation and just flux it. But there is one problem. The radial velocity information is in the slope of your spectrum. Like if you have a flat spectrum, whether you blue shift or red shift, you don't really have any information in it. But if you have a slope in your spectrum because of some emission line or absorption line, then a small shift can actually be detected. But any interpolation, if you use a finite polynomial, because there are higher orders in the signal, you will end up slightly smoothing your spectrum. And this is a big problem because you will essentially lose the radial velocity information in your spectrum each time you interpolate it. But then we tried to look at what are the options that we have. Claude Shannon has promised, actually it's not really Claude Shannon, but the Nyquist theorem proposed by Cauchy long back, as that if you are Nyquist sampling your signal, there should be mathematically some way to recover your signal irrespective of the way you sampled it. So the way this the idea is actually really simple. When you have a signal like this, when you measure it on a pixel, you are actually convolving that with the response of your pixel, and then you are measuring the value of the flux of that convolved thing. So convolving here in the Fourier space, so let's say this is the Fourier transform of your signal, convolving of the pixel corresponds to just multiplying by a sinc function in the Fourier space, and then sampling is like multiplying with a Dirac delta function, and since we know Dirac delta functions, Fourier transform is again a Dirac delta function, in the Fourier space it is equivalent to convolving this with the Dirac comp. So what you end up with the sample signal, which is a thing that actually measure out of a CCD, is the, in the Fourier space is just this same signal repeated in the Fourier space. And if you are Nyquist sampling it or over sampling it, there will be a gap between these two. There won't be any overlap between these two things. Now all you have to do is design a band pass filter so that you just pick out one thing out of it. Like you essentially zero out everything and you end up recovering the original signal. So this is the basic idea of band limited interpolation or Shannon's interpolation. So this is something which I tried to implement, and what you see here is the nice result. Like you can see these dots here are the real data, it's a real spectrum. The black line that you see, the smooth line which you see passing through it, is what you get if I do random 30,000 interpolations by shifting the coordinates by a cubic spline interpolation. You end up pretty much averaging out a lot of the features in the spectrum and you lose all the RV information. But on the other hand, the same number of times, what I'm calling here casing is essentially band limited interpolation with a Kayser upper dissection, but that's just a detail. You end up preserving the shape of the spectrum even after doing 30,000 iterations on it. And now all I have to do is extend this into two dimensions, which is very easy because Fourier transforms are very easy to deal in higher dimensions as well. If I have a two-dimensional spectrum like this, let's say this is the two-dimensional Fourier transform of my spectrum, and when you are observing this on a CCD, it's a two-dimensional Dirac comp, and you convolve it, you end up with a two-dimensional comp of the convolutions, and this is all you have to do is design a two-dimensional filter to recover this. And this is just that algorithm in action. This is the original picture. If I do a simple linear algorithm after almost 1,000 random interpolations, you pretty much lose all the signal. But if cubic spline, you still lose it, it kind of averages out. But if you're using a band limited, you still preserve everything in it. So this is just the result of that. This is one which real data convolved with this. This is something an in algorithm in infancy. We are still studying its other unknown artifacts on the data. So we are also parallelly using couple of other algorithms like polygon clipping, etc., which is known to be more robust, even though it compromises on losing some RV information. All right, so now you can make your instrument really stable, but still you will not get centimeter per second resolution when you actually look at a star. This is mainly because, irrespective of the fact that your instrument is stable, the star itself is not stable. This is how a typical star looks. It's actually our sun, but so you can see that lot of things happening, and the star itself is rotating. So you have a blue shift here, you have a red shift there, and we kind of rely on the fact that they all average out to get a stable radial velocity light signal from the spectrum, which is the average of all of these things together. But of course, in reality, this is not a uniform disk. All stars have various weird things happening. For example, even like the convection flows are like typically in kilometer per second. We are talking about centimeter per second, but when the surface of the star itself has kilometer per second flows, and they don't always average out. And there are of course even acoustic P modes in these low mass stars, which have a lot of convections, which are typically in a meter per second, which we can detect with our spectrograph, which for us is very bad thing because that affects us from discovering planets. But there are of course other area of astrophysics, astroseismology, where people are actually interested in that thing. But anyway, the point is, all of these from our perspective are nuisance. We have to figure out how to remove from our spectrum. And a lot of work actually is done on how to actually disentangle the stellar activity radial velocity shifts from actual planetary signals. So the point, the basic idea is that, for example, if there is a sunspot on the star, as it moves around, you get a shift in the change in the profile of the lines itself, which will give you a fake centroid shift, which will look like a radial velocity shift. So you try to detect for any of the correlation, other lines which are more correlated with, usually there are these certain lines which calcium HK lines which are known to correlate well with stellar activity. You try to look for those wavelength, those emission lines or absorption lines, whatever is there, and see whether what is the signal they give and try to remove that from your radial velocity signal. So it's a field by itself, which I should mention, because even if you build a centimeter per second instrument, if you can't solve this problem, there is no way we are going to get centimeter per second detection in a star. And then the last final magic of how actually we calculate radial velocity from the spectrum, the traditional method was to use CCF method, which is a cross correlation mask. It's essentially a rectangular pulse where the pulse heights are adjusted depending on the specific lines we are interested in. And the weights of those lines are essentially the heavily guarded secrets of every exoplanet research community. There is no way one community will share that mask with another community, because that determines whether you detect a planet or not. But this method will not work for M-type stars. I mean, it will work for M-type stars, but it's not really the optimal way, because M-type stars, most of the information is actually in the continuum, because there are so many lines and the continuum itself has so much slopes in it, which we can use to fit the radial velocities. You don't have to just rely on specific lines inside a spectrum. So we developed something called segmented least square method, which the basic idea is that you kind of look the spectrum, adaptively segment the spectrum based on the radial velocity information in it, and then you try to weight them so that the line, certain regions are more sensitive to stellar activity, they kind of anti-correlate with your estimated RV measurements and so on. Alright, so I've been telling, so in the last few slides I'll quickly show you what we have achieved so far with the HPF. So this is, by the way, the HPF after installation. You can see the VPH prism here. And this chamber, by the way, is the NUID. So we literally have two spectrographs side by side. And we are finishing this, and we finished this already. And this is our early results in the lab. So in the lab, we connected, we didn't really have the laser comb ready to test it in the lab. So we used a not that stable fiber Fabry Ferro. With a super K continuum source for this wavelength, and we shone that light all through all the three fibers. This is the calibration fiber, science fiber, and the sky fiber, and we looked at the inter fiber radial velocity drifts. And we found that we are easily reaching somewhere around like 25 centimeter per second in lab, which is well within 1 meter per second we want to achieve on the sky. And this too was not really done at a very good conditions. For fun, we also did take the first stellar spectrum. We just kind of, instead of before going to the 10 meter Hobie-Eberle telescope, we just connected a tiny telescope. In fact, we are actually using the viewfinder of this telescope, so it's a really tiny telescope, and we shone that light into the spectrograph to get where all the telluric lines is. So you can see these are all the telluric lines. None of these lines belong to the sun because you can't really see it unless you remove the telluric lines. This will help you appreciate how much effort needs to be done in looking for radial velocities in between these telluric lines. Like, there is no way you can recover, at least the present algorithms, there is no way you can recover the radial velocity where there is a telluric line. You have to look for in between those lines. So this is our instrument being sent to the 10 meter Hobie-Eberle telescope, which is shown over here on a FedEx truck. There is our instrument. There is our PI sitting so tensed. And this is our victory photo once we had the instrument installed inside the basement. This is by the Suvrat Mahadev, who is the PI of our instrument. And this is the first, so we decide, so the high resolution mode of the spectrograph was still not fully functional. We decided to go on sky with the high efficiency mode and just see that everything else is working. So this is what the first high efficiency mode spectrum we took, the star spectrum and the sky spectrum you can see next to each other. And this was before the instrument has reached anything that you can call stable. We are just filled in liquid nitrogen, we are cooling down. When we could easily get 50 meter per second even before the instrument has even stabilized in this high efficiency mode of the instrument. The actual high resolution mode of the instrument happened just the week before I came here. So in fact, I was just flying directly from the observatory. This is the first light spectrum that we got of on the HPF. You can see these are the Fabry-Perot lines. So we would really, I mean, we still have uranium, neon and thorium argon lines for wavelength calibrations, but they are only good to few meter per second. They are never good for centimeter per second wavelength calibration. So that's why we are using laser frequency comb. So this is how the laser frequency comb would look. Even though this is in the calibration fiber, this is a star spectrum and the sky spectrum. So this is just a sample spectrum taken on 2nd of December. Instrument has, by the way, now stabilized. This was our champagne bottle to celebrate the first light. You can see all these champagne bottles, which are other instruments at the McDonald Observatory. And stay tuned for the first results. So it will be published in at the AAAS conference on January 8th at Washington. So let's get back. This is, by the way, we drinking champagne on a coffee mug because we couldn't find any champagne glasses. All right. So there are a lot of things I skipped in this talk, which are all very key aspects. For example, the control system. Even though HPF does not have any, or NUIT does not have any moving parts, there are a lot of independent components which we have to actively control. So a Python twisted based asynchronous system was developed, which will be soon publishing it as a public code so that future instruments can use the same code. We made it as general as possible so that we could use it for both HPF and the NUIT spectrographs. The other thing which I completely skipped over is the frequency comb, even though I barely mentioned about it a couple of times. That project is almost as costly as the spectrograph itself. So it's a huge project by itself, probably much long talks has to be given on for justice to that. So it's essentially a complete replacement for cathode lamps, which are not really good for centimeter per second resolution accuracy. Completely skipped about the calibration bench unit, completely skipped about the telluric lines, solar scattering, scattered light, the grating scattering, target acquisition of how we do it, the splicing of fibers, there's a lot of work involved in it. In fact, Shubham, who is here, is like the splicing and guy, so you can ask him in doubts if you have. The one thing I want to mention is that most of the work actually went into simulations. Like, a centimeter per second is really unforgiving. You make a small mistake somewhere in the chain of your building the instrument, you will never be able to trace back once you finish the instrument. So at every single step we did a lot of simulations, whether it's CMAX, SolidWorks, or even general codes, to make sure that every single new component we add is making the change exactly as our simulations are showing. and which was a lot of R&D went into those simulation stages, and most of these simulation codes are also will be publicly released so that future instruments can use them. And this team, I mean, the instrument couldn't be built without the so much huge talent we have spread across various different institutes, even though most of the people are at Penn State, but we also have people from all these different places. NIST is where the HPS calibrate, the frequency comb is being developed, and we have all these people in the team to thank for the exciting instrument that we are building. With that, I will leave the floor open for questions. Thank you.
Really an exciting instrument building, and also giving you that almost covered fresh data. Looks like the first slide is shown here. So it's very, very exciting for all of us. Okay, so more questions? Problem?
I see one problem.
Yeah.
See, suppose you detect a planet around M dwarf, but because of the activity,
So there's a lot of work. In fact, there was a review article on the habitability of M dwarf planets. So earlier people thought that this activity will completely, and they are usually very close, so they might be tidally locked, and you may not really have the day-night cycle, which might again not prevent the time form. So earlier simulations were they just use a simple plate models of climate, didn't show any interesting features. But the new simulations were they have the proper 3D structures. They found that even if they are tidally locked with really active sun on one star, you can have really interesting flows from both sides of the planets, and you can really have interesting atmospheres at those intersection places. And then there is again this question that how long is this activity going to remain? So typically M dwarf stars probably won't be habitable for something like 8 giga years. By the time they are 8 giga years, their activity and the rotation periods will considerably reduce, and then you have much, if the planet survived that initial 8 giga years and it can hold on to its atmosphere, which is usually possible if you consider the fact that initially they also have better magnetic fields which can preserve their atmospheres. So you can, so people claim that you can still have life form starting after 8 giga years, even if you assume that there is nothing to protect it initially when the star was really active phase. So yeah, it is, there is a lot of papers which on this trying to see whether it is possible to have life, but again these are not really, I mean, we, unless we detect something, there is really no way of saying whether we are right or wrong. There won't be enough
metal to start with.
Oh, okay, okay, okay. Okay, rocky planet, right?
So yeah. Then 5 plus 8, 13 plus 6.
Right, right. Yes, that's true. So, but I mean, there is always again counter papers which says that even when it is active, you can on the far side of the planet, you can have really interesting life forms forming, and which are heated up by the flow of the atmosphere from these sides. So, yeah. It is, unless we detect, we have, we won't know.
So, up to what magnitude will this be complete, let's say? Up to what distance, let's say?
So, in terms of magnitudes, we can, for this is on a 10 meter telescope, which because of the central obscuration, etc., you can almost think of it as a 7 meter, 8 meter telescope. You can get this level of precision up to 12 magnitude in I magnitude. And for M dwarfs that's usually good, because in J it will be slightly more brighter. You can't really get this precision because you will not be photon noise limited at fainter stars than that.
So you won't be able to do the Kepler field?
No.
So it's K2 maybe?
Not even K2, this probably TESS objects, because TESS will be looking at nearby stars, and no, Kepler and K2, no way. I mean, there are a couple of one or two sources. Yeah, there's those sources, but they are much smaller in number. Yeah. That one I think we started with 15 seconds. So there is a guaranteed time on the telescope for doing a very systematic survey. So the way the survey is designed is we start with a we'll of course initial few months will be spent mostly on standard stars so that we can demonstrate that the instrument is stable. So we'll be looking at stars which are known to have planets and recover and show that we are detecting all of these. And we will also be of course looking at, so there is this divisions done on these are the most likely, most interesting kind of thing. So we have selected almost around 150 M dwarfs for HPFs to be specific, which we'll be continuously monitoring. And plus, of course, this instrument will be open to other observers who wants to do other observations. They can always do. For in fact, I did observe a couple of T Tauri stars, which I have earlier worked on when you are at TIF or like some protoplanetary disks, etc. This is really cool high resolution near infrared instrument for anything, even if you are not doing radial velocity. So, yeah, you can do all sorts of things.
Okay.
Yeah.
You want to discuss about polarization, but two polarizations will have different reflective indices.
Right.
And again, passing through the atmosphere under the magnetic field, etc. There too, because of the changes, are you going to have any effect?
So the polarization change, the major effect is not going to be from the atmosphere, it's from the grating itself. Because grating have different efficiency for different polarization, and we are putting a polarization scrambler in our optical fibers, which will also scramble the polarization a bit if it is stellar in origin, that which is really small compared to the polarizations which will get created inside the spectrograph. So we are optimize, so the this wavefront correction which SIGO people do, they can do it only for one polarization, they can't do it for both polarizations. Usually the corrections are similar for both, but there is a slight difference. So they are actually optimizing it for the polarization which has the maximum efficiency for the grating, so that you have minimum and which is pretty much enough for our lambda by 4 requirement we have for the wavefront error of the prism.
But whatever you are doing the corrections,
it doesn't really vary that much over the HPF things, but yes, true. I mean, it theoretically it will be valid for exactly one wavelength, but it's a very small fall off, like it doesn't really vary much. But that's true, yeah. I mean, correction will be at exactly one particular.
Okay, I think if there are no more questions, let us once again thank you for your very good.
Thank you.